This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's talk about plain speaking. I mentioned this at the beginning of the first hour. I'd hoped to get to it in the first hour. I didn't. So I'm going to make the basic topic of this hour. And it has to do with just saying right out loud what's going on. Donald Trump, for example, is a racist. Richard Wolff in today's Guardian. Not the economist, the op-ed writer, the commentator. He says, let's drop the euphemisms. Donald Trump is a racist president. He said, he starts out saying, a lot of people think that Trump is just crazy or there's, incoherence going on here. It's just like random. He says, watching this pinball president ricochet around Europe, you could be forgiven for thinking there's no method to Donald Trump's madness. And then he goes through a list of things that Trump, NATO's a ripoff and Theresa May is no good. And then now NATO's very strong and Theresa May is wonderful and, et cetera, et cetera. And you go, what the hell is going on here? Well, actually, there is something that's very, very consistent. As Richard Wolff writes, immigration is where Trump's journey begins and ends. The message running all the way through this stick of rock, right? And I would add immigration and the role that race plays in that. Trump's comments while he's standing next to Theresa May about how Great Britain has, its character has changed, its culture has changed, and not for the better. What does he mean by that? People with darker skin are increasing their numbers relative to the white skin population or pale-skinned population of the UK and of Europe broadly. And a lot of them are immigrants. Richard Wolff goes on to say, Trump has mused before about how good it would be to deport people without judges messing things up. He doesn't consider his own country's ample immigration laws to be actual laws that he respects. He said, this is the language and mentality of so many extreme right and neo-Nazi parties in Europe today, Richard Wolff is writing. He goes on to say this should not be a surprise, and it shouldn't be. This is the guy who, back when President Obama was elected, started and became the principal national spokesman for, and I believe as a consequence of, was given a regular Tuesday morning slot on Fox and Friends for years. I think it was 5 or 6 years that Trump was on every single week on Fox and Friends to talk about how America's first black president shouldn't be in the White House, should be removed from the White House, because he was born in Kenya. The whole birtherism thing. Trump began with racism in his modern political incarnation. I mean, he began with racism back when he was a kid, when he was in Brooklyn, and his dad was a landlord. And Trump was involved with the group that if somebody came in and made an application to rent from Fred Trump, and they were black, they put the little letter C somewhere in the upper left-hand corner, I believe it was, or the upper right-hand corner of the application, and it was kind of inconspicuous. And when they saw the C, they knew, it's a colored person. And of course, suddenly, the apartments were all sold out. That's where Trump started. His father was arrested in a Klan riot, and it wasn't because he was protesting the Klan. From there, he goes to becoming a wealthy businessman in New York. And when a woman is raped and left for dead in Central Park, turns out by a white guy who is a serial rapist, Trump accuses five black teenagers of it and whips up hysteria to the point that he's buying, I think it was a full-page ad. If it wasn't, it was huge. In any case, a large ad in the New York Times demanding the death penalty for the Central Park Five, who were exonerated, and he continues to call them guilty. If you want to know who Trump is going after in his tweets, all you have to do is look at the color of the skin of the people he's attacking 9 times out of 10. NFL, he's going after black players. Black Lives Matter, he's going after. Members of Congress, let's find a black woman. That's a twofer. And go after Maxine Waters. I mean, this is not dog whistle. This is bullhorn. He launched his presidential campaign with this whole rant about how the rapists are coming from Mexico, which is an echo of reefer madness in the 1920s. We got to criminalize marijuana because when those black people smoke it, they can't stop raping white women. Right? That, yeah, these are these old racist tropes. Trump's second thing that he does in all, I mean, the first thing he does is he lets the coal companies dump more of their waste into the rivers. That's sure going to help the average working person poison their children with their drinking water. Second thing he does is he pushes through his Muslim ban. Oh, did you notice most of those Muslims he's banning have darker skin than, for example, Donald Trump does or I do? And now he's unleashed ICE, this deportation force, on anyone who even looks remotely Latino. And now they're going back through people who have become U.S. citizens, naturalized U.S. citizens, to see if they lied about anything so they can remove their citizenship and deport them retroactively. And I guarantee you he's not starting with the Norwegians or the Germans or the Irish immigrants. I guarantee you. I don't have the proof, but I would bet anything. Which brings me to a piece written by one of the leading experts on the Holocaust and on genocide studies. He's a historian. He's a lecturer at the University of Virginia. His name is named Waitman Wade Bourne, B-E-O-R-N. And you can read his piece in today's Washington Post. And the headline is, Parallels Lie in Authoritarianism, Racism, Ethnic Myths, and Dehumanizing Language, Not the Final Solution. And the argument that he's making in this article, and it's a really brilliant article, and I strongly encourage you to check it out in today's Washington Post, is that, yes, when people speak of the Holocaust in the United States, typically what we're talking about is the Holocaust, the so-called Final Solution, which began in 1941, the murder of the Jews, and the trade unionists, and the communists, and the gays, and the gypsies, and ultimately even some of the Catholics, but principally the murder of the Jews. But he says, take that out of the equation for the moment. And I realize that's difficult to do, particularly if you're Jewish, but there was more going on between 1933 and 1941. In fact, there was very little, killing of Jews going on outside of the work camps like Dachau. It was not a death camp, it was a labor camp. Sort of like privatized prisons, only, much more extreme. But anyhow, he said, there's no reason that historical comparisons between what is going on right now in this country and around the world with this hard swing to the right and the Nazis. He says, there's no reason that historical comparisons must immediately center on the Final Solution, the murder of Jews. The Nazis themselves did not begin with that solution in mind. He said genocides and dictatorships, for that matter, don't just spring into his existence. They begin incrementally. First, authoritarianism. I alone can solve these problems. Then racism. Oh, it's the Mexican rapists. Then ethnic myths. These people are animals. And dehumanizing language. He said this is where Holocaust comparisons can and should be made. And I'm making them right now. The Nuremberg race laws. Now, these were the laws in Germany that said that if you had a certain percentage of Jewish blood, that you couldn't be a German citizen any longer. The Nuremberg race laws were based on an earlier version employed in the colony of Germany in Southwest Africa called Namibia. Hitler himself looked to Roman antiquity, I'm quoting from the article in the Washington Post now, as a partial inspiration for his planned intentional starvation policies in Eastern Europe. He called the Spanish conquistador Cortez a moderate man. Cortez, of course, engaged in genocide in the northern part of South America. Adolf Hitler referred to Thomas Jefferson's Indian removal policies, which were genocidal, admiringly, and he called the Volga River our Mississippi. This is Adolf Hitler saying, the Volga River is our Mississippi, where inferior races must be driven. Hitler further stated that, quote, natives of Eastern Europe should be looked upon as redskins. Right? America engaged in ethnic cleansing and massive genocide. We can too. Hitler admiringly commented that America, using racist guidelines, had, quote, established specific criteria for immigration in an attempt to maintain racial purity. And it was true. And it's what Trump is trying to bring us back to. So he says you don't have to begin in 1941 to find these parallels. In fact, it's important not to, but to look at the beginnings. How does this stuff begin? And then you ask, you know, where does it go? Right? But where, how does it begin? So when I come back from the break, I'm going to go through some of the how is it beginning, again from this fellow's article in today's Washington Post. And to give credit where credit is due, the title is Parallels, Lies, and Lie in Authoritarianism, Racism, Ethnic Myths, and Dehumanizing Language, Not the Final Solution, by Waitman Wade Bourne in today's Washington Post. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what are the parallels? Stick around. And welcome back. Morris listening in on KPFK in Los Angeles. Hey, Morris in Long Beach, California. What's up?
Hey, Professor, here we go. I'm running for president, everybody. Donald Trump, he got him a base. I'm going to get me a base.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. No, if you make less than $1 million in this country, you're not paying no more income taxes. I'm going to give you free health care. I'm going to give you free education. Okay, and nobody's going to go to sleep hungry at night. I wish somebody would ask me how I'm going to pay for all this.
How are you going to pay for all this, Morris?
I'm so glad you asked that. Okay, there's a little bit of, you know about the Panama Papers. There's a little bit of money over there. But remember when the Swiss got busted and had to pay a $3.2 billion fine because they were housing some money over there and people were hiding their money over there so they wouldn't have to pay taxes on it? Here's what I'm going to do, Professor. I'm going to pull a Putin. Let me tell you what Putin did. He told those oligarchs in Russia, if you don't bring your money back over here and put it back in this country, I'm going to find it and I'm going to take it from you. And that's what I'm going to do. And that's how I'm going to finance my new society. We're going to make America great again, everybody. We're going to eliminate the billionaire class. We're going to go back to when Jacob Paul Getty was the only guy that had anywhere near $1 billion. So anyone that criticizes my program or doesn't think it's going to come to pass, they're one of the people that's got some money over there in Switzerland.
Yeah. And by the way, it wasn't just Putin. Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, effectively the ruler of Saudi Arabia right now, because the king is, you know, febrile. He did the same thing. He brought all the oligarchs into the whichever hotel it was, one of the fancy hotels there, and locked them down and said, you know, bring your money back to Saudi Arabia and give me a piece of it. I think you're onto something, Morris. I wish you well. Keep us up to date on how the campaign is going. Chaz in Lakewood, Washington. Hey, Chaz, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Comrade, is another glorious day in Trumpistan, is it not?
Indeed.
And listen, I think I can effectively prove collusion. You ready for this?
Sure.
All right. At first, Trump was, there was no hacking. And then later on, he backed up and said, well, yeah, there was hacking, but it wasn't the Russians. And then he backed up and said, well, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But yesterday, we found out that Trump said, gotten everybody, listen, Russia, thing to say, listen, Russia, if you can hack those 30,000 emails, you'd be doing everybody a big favor. And they did it that day.
That's correct.
That's not causation. I don't know what is. That is collusion.
Yeah, that goes way beyond correlation to causation, I think. If you were running Russia and you did not like Hillary Clinton because of her position on Ukraine and other things, and then the Republican candidate for president said, hey, help me out here, publicly, right in front of America and the world, what would you do, Chaz?
How are our grandfathers not spinning in their graves having full Cold War for an entire generation? You remember duck and cover.
I do. Yeah, I do. And where are the Republicans? I mean, this is bizarre. Chaz, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. and I do appreciate it. Wow. In just a second, we're going to be hitting a break. In fact, here it comes right now. And I'm going to get back to what's going on right now. Stick around. So, first, Professor Bourne, he's a professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies, or historian and lecturer at the University of Virginia. He's the author of a book called Marching into Darkness, The Wehrmacht and the Holocaust in Belarus, and the author of a book titled The Holocaust in Eastern Europe at the Epicenter of the Final Solution. First of all, he lays out the argument that, yes, we should be talking about the Holocaust and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and today in the United States. That in doing so, we should focus not on what happened after 1941, that is the extermination camps, but instead everything that happened between 1933 and 1941, in that intervening period, when Germany went from being a functioning democracy to becoming an authoritarian dictatorship. And then he points out Trump's he says, Trump, as a presidential candidate, explicitly made appeals to violence during his campaign. This is something Hitler did. He said it's useful to focus on the early periods of the Nazi movement, the rise to prominence. Trump's well-documented use of dehumanizing language is another clear similarity to the early stages of Nazi rule. His toleration of modern Nazi groups in the United States, epitomized by his relativist blame on both sides comment, indicates that the history of the Holocaust and the Nazis must continue to be part of our critique. The Nazis who descended on Charlottesville screamed blood and soil. It was the same racist slogan that was used by Hitler's followers in Germany. He said politically parallels to those of the early Nazi movement, they're all over the place. He says, in fact, he says, as Evans rightly notes, his propaganda machine would be immediately familiar to Joseph Goebbels' Nazi office. And I would put Fox News, frankly, into that. The recent executive order, he writes, making administrative law judges political appointees subject to executive power, cannot be seen as anything less than an attempt to bring the courts in line with Trump's political ideology, with the administration's political ideology. The Nazis called this Gleichschaltung, or coordination. Even in his management style, Trump has similarities to Hitler. Like Trump, Hitler was reluctant to surrender too much authority to any one subordinate, and so his cabinet was a den of backbiting and maneuvering underlings seeking the support of Hitler, who was the only one who decided policy. And if you don't think that Trump's cabinet has no say in policy, look at what happened yesterday in Helsinki. I mean, his advisors, his defense people, his intelligence people, the members of his cabinet, and his senior intelligence people, they had all laid out this plan. Here's, you're going to take on Putin, and here's how you're going to do it, blah, 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 blah. And boom, Trump went nuts. Trump went off on it. And then he says, this is real stuff. By the way, we're gonna do a, I'm going to unlock the lines, Walter. Arthur, I'm sorry. We will do this later on. Back to this. He says these historic comparisons are not hyperbolic. He said John Fitzgerald, a GOP congressional candidate in California, stated live on the radio that, quote, everything we've been told about the Holocaust is a lie. He went on to receive 23% of the primary votes cast, making him the Republican candidate for the House of Representatives. This is not an isolated event. In Illinois, Holocaust denier Arthur Jones won the Republican primary for the state house. The most prominent conservative challenger for Republican Paul Ryan's seat from Wisconsin is a white nationalist and an anti-Semite. After all, he writes, the historical Nazis did not seize power illegally at first. They were elected. We need to learn the lessons of history. We'll be back with your calls on this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
So what do you see? What are the comparisons that you see, and how best do you think we should fight back? I think we just need to mobilize a massive public. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Apropos of our conversation in the previous hour about voting machines and the insecurity of our election systems and the beating heart of democracy, to paraphrase Thomas Paine and all of that, one of our listeners, Dorothy, sends a note to the Oregon Election Commission's online Twitter account. It's at Oregon Elections. And asks the question, says, the New York Times says, 25 states use an ESNS DS200 that can be easily hacked if it has a cellular feature. They don't know which states use this cellular feature. What optical scanner does Oregon use? And the Oregon Board of Elections tweets back minutes ago. Actually, no, this was about a month ago. Sorry. So, but I was just brought to my attention just now by Dorothy. None of Oregon's tally machines use cellular. They are all secured in a county office with security cameras and are on a closed network within the elections office that is not connected to the internet. And that's the magic phrase. Again, I would like to see these be boxes that are owned by the state, and they may well be, running software that is developed by the state on an open source basis, which I'm pretty sure is not the case. But anyway, a lot of stuff here to unpack. Kathleen in Avondale, Arizona. Hey, Kathleen, what's on your mind?
Well, I called to say that I called my senator, which is Senator Flake,
mm-hmm.
and told him that I appreciated the fact that he made a strong statement, but that I needed more than words. He has said a lot of words, but I needed a little more than that. I needed some action. And I also spoke to Senator McConnell's office and said basically the same thing,
yeah.
that I thought that his performance in Helsinki was appalling and that he didn't stand up for America and that he needed to do something, action, not words. And regarding the election, you know, I live in Arizona, and our election system was hacked. And so I don't know if they have our information.
Well, and the other thing we don't know is from 2006 to 2012, during that six-year period, there were three elections, three major elections. And, you know, how many of them might have been altered in what states and in what ways? We have no idea. All we know is that the Republicans are now in charge of everything.
I know. And I'm really concerned about how secure our votes are. We do have mail-in ballots here, but they still get scanned. And I don't know how they're tabulated.
Right.
You know.
Right. And this
I don't know.
There should be an absolute federal law against privatizing elections. It should just be that simple. We should have gone down the road of privatizing elections when we did this in 2002. It was insane. And all of a sudden we started seeing this magic thing called redshift, where the exit polls said the Democrats won. But gee, wasn't it a surprise? The Republican candidates actually were the ones that the voting machines said we all voted for. And this has been going on since 2002 in a big way, and you can easily Google this. There's not even a secret. So, yeah, spot on. Kathleen, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Richard in Durham, North Carolina. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind?
Yes, Tom, I'd like to know if so many people believe that Putin has something on Trump. And from watching that fiasco yesterday, I was wondering if it's possible to subpoena the only two other people in the room were the interpreters.
Correct. And those interpreters typically make notes while they're doing their interpreting, so that if there's any question from either party later, and those notes, to the best of my knowledge, are not subject to subpoena because this took place in Helsinki. Although I'm really no expert on this, Richard, I it's possible, because it was the President of the United States in his official capacity as President of the United States, that under the Presidential Records Act, that there has to be some, you know, I don't know. And we also know that Donald Trump doesn't necessarily, you know, follow the rules or obey the law, shall we say.
Well, so. You see, I think that the Congress can subpoena, and that the fact that I remember
Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are not going to do that, Richard.
I know they're not going to do it, but we could raise the issue and bring the subject up so that it becomes part of the national dialogue or debate.
That's a good idea. And I think that's already happening. And frankly, the way to do this is if we can get enough people to the polls in November to get Democratic control of at least the House of Representatives, then they will have the power of the subpoena. And whether they can subpoena the translator notes or not, I frankly don't know. I hope to find out, or intend to find out. But they can subpoena a heck of a lot of people and information that might give us a lot of insights into this. Richard, thank you so much for the call. There's another point that you mentioned, which is, you know, what does Putin have on Trump? And, you know, my personal theory on this is that it's not the pee-pee tape. I don't think that Trump cares if they're, you know, if Trump hired a couple of prostitutes to urinate on the bed that Barack Obama and Michelle Obama had slept in a couple of years earlier in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel or whatever it was, I'm pretty sure it was the Ritz, in Moscow. I think, frankly, you know, if that tape were to get out, his base would be even more enthusiastic about him. You know what? You know, a couple of, you know, white hookers peeing on the beds that America's first black president slept in. You know, if that was true, and I'm perfectly willing to think that it's true that he hired it and had it done, whether or not the Russians have the tape or not, who, I don't know. But even if the Russians do have the tape, I don't think that's what they're blackmailing him with. I don't think they have to blackmail him. I think that because of his multiple bankruptcies, because he's such a terrible negotiator and such a terrible businessman, his failed steak company, his failed board game company, his failed parts of his failed clothing company, his failed casinos, his failed bottled water company, his failed airline, it just goes on and on, his failed college that was convicted of fraud. Because he's such a terrible businessman and negotiator, Donald Trump, and therefore ended up with a half a dozen bankruptcies or thereabouts, Donald Trump could no longer borrow money in the United States. And if you're a real estate developer, you can't do business if you can't borrow money. So he turned to oligarchs around the world, to billionaires around the world, and said, hey, you want to invest some money in my operations? I'll pay a good interest rate. You can get some real estate. You can launder money. You can launder ill-gotten gains through Trump properties. And he got into bed with some really sketchy people of the billionaire persuasion who were not Americans. And many of them were Russians. And I'm guessing, given that Eric Trump back in, I think it was 2013, said we don't need to take money from American banks anymore. We get all the money we need from Russia. This is his son who was in charge of making it happen. I'm guessing that if the Russian oligarchs, who have to, you know, they have to respond to Putin. Putin runs the country. He can change the laws. He can take away their money. In fact, he's done it. He can put them in prison. In fact, he's done it. There are Russian oligarchs, billionaires, that Putin has put in prison. If the Russian oligarchs were to say to Trump, we want our money back right now, Trump's entire business empire would crumble. It would be the end of Donald Trump. It would be the end of Ivanka and Eric and Don Jr. No more big game, you know, hunting trips to Africa to kill giraffes and elephants. No more, you know, Ivanka having her own line of clothing and accessories made in China. No more Trump hotels. No more golf courses. Nothing. Donald Trump and his family would become homeless and penniless. In my opinion. Now, I do not have the kind of evidence that, you know, you would need to write a piece for the New York Times about this. This is my gut. My gut is that the reason he won't reveal his tax returns is because without that Russian billionaire money, he would be broke and penniless and homeless. He would lose Mar-a-Lago. He would lose everything. And so he's literally fighting for his life, or what he perceives to be his life. He's literally fighting for his lifestyle when he's sucking up to the Russians, in my opinion. Now, again, I could be completely wrong on this, but I think that, you know, follow the money was you know, Mark Felt's advice to Bob Woodward, Deep Throat's advice. Mark Felt, the number two guy in the FBI, said, follow the money. That advice, in my opinion, still holds. And I think if we were to follow Trump's money, and I believe that Robert Mueller is doing that right now, we're going to find out that without Russian help, Trump is broke. He's busted. He's nobody. He's nothing. And that's what he was trying to protect. He was trying to protect his family and his business and his reputation as a brilliant business, as a very stable genius. I don't think he was worried about a pee-pee tape getting out. As I said, I mean, you know, if he could survive the crotch-grabbing tape getting out, which is far worse, at least in the eyes of his supporters, the pee-pee tape is nothing. So, anyhow, let's hit a break here, and oh, I shouldn't have done that, because we've got
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TalkMediaNews.com for audio and video archives.
And welcome back. Let's see here. Al in Weston, Texas. Hey, Al, what's on your mind?
Tom, I was going to talk about Helsinki, but after your discussion about Mr. Bourne, Professor Bourne, it'd be great if you could have him on in terms of going a little further in depth and what he sees as possible maneuvers, tactics, routes that we can take to kind of hinder, if not stop, this progression of fascism.
That's a very good suggestion, Al. That's a very good suggestion.
And one of the things, what it comes down to is after that, I was talking with a friend of mine who lives in Palm Beach, and they pretty much openly use the Nazi word regarding him.
Palm Beach is where Mar-a-Lago is?
Well, what it comes down to is everyone always says invoking Hitler and Nazism is you lose the battle. There's no other frame of reference considering the pattern that has progressed from going back to the early 2000s to where we are today. You cannot use as a frame of reference just fascism. This is Nazism. Everyone who's listening to you in the world, in Europe, in the Pacific Rim, really, really need to take notice about what is going on here. What happened in Europe, he definitely wants to pull out of NATO. I wouldn't be surprised if he kicks out the United Nations in the next 2 years if he stays in office. We are essentially becoming Hitler land. We are becoming a Nazi state.
Well, we're becoming, I've got a caller, I think his name is Chaz, who regularly calls and says, you know, another fine day in Trumpistan. We're becoming Trumpistan.
And what it comes down to is anyone, Mitch McConnell, any senator who, even though they hate him, back him, they're Nazi sympathizers.
Yeah.
And there's no ifs, ands, or buts anymore at this point. I could easily see the Supreme Court becoming essentially what I just talked about with Henry VIII and the Man for All Seasons. He's creating a star chamber which will go after any kind of political enemies, political rivals, as he and the party see fit. It is no longer a conservative party. It is no longer a Republican party. It is a Nazi party. It is MAGA party. It is Make America Great. His going to Helsinki was essentially to get more marching orders from Putin, and whatever transpires in this country, if not the world, in the next few months, if not years, is definitely part of the Putin plan for essentially
the Soviet Union arising. Pardon the interruption, but we've just got 40 seconds here. Here's the question. I've been reading, and I'm still only about halfway through it. It's a slow read of Fritz Thyssen's book, I Paid Hitler. He was the leading, he was the Charles Koch of his day in Germany in the 1930s. And he funded the rise of Hitler. And at what point do you think that the industrialists, the billionaires, the Mercers, the Kochs, the Adelsons, and a whole bunch of them whose names we don't know, but they're there, at what point are these business people going to say, you know, we thought we were just installing a guy who was going to make us richer. Oops.
When they, when, when America completely collapses, because at what point did Thiessen say we made a mistake? Did he say that while Hitler was on the ascendancy, or did he say it when Germany lost?
He said it when the war with Russia started. Yeah.
Okay, well, yeah. That's halfway through, so yeah. Maybe there was enlightenment, but then again, Thiessen was maybe a more reasonable man compared to Koch.
As far as I can tell, like I said, I haven't finished his book, but, you know, that's the question in my mind. At what point are these billionaires going to do the forehead slap and go, oh, my God. Anyhow, we'll be right back. Let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world today. This report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and Loving What You Do, Alan Ratner's new book. And Arthur, I can't put Luke on until you let go of him. Arthur? There we go. Okay. Luke Vargas. Hey, Luke.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Great. Where are you?
I'm in Helsinki still.
Still are. Okay. So what's in the news?
Well, let's shift away from here, unless you've got any pressing questions to sort of follow
no,
up on what happened yesterday.
I think, you know, it's been well covered by the news.
There are two things I've been watching. The first is an interesting story coming out of North Korea, where we have seen now in the pages of the country's main propaganda newspaper today, a 9-page spread complete with photographs in which Kim Jong-un methodically disparages the state of economic development in one of the country's northern provinces named North Hamgyong. And North Korea watchers that I've talked to have said this is quite unprecedented, that the central propaganda organs of the country would be airing so much dirt from their leader on the status of the country. Let me give you some of the highlights. I think they're kind of entertaining in a way, and then we can talk about their broader importance. But he goes to a hotel, a resort that's been under construction for 6 years, and there's not even plaster on the walls. And there are photos of him looking at sauna or soaking tubs, and he says they're filthy. You know, people shouldn't even, you know, like wash their clothes in these, let alone be in them. He goes to a bag factory, what is intended to be kind of a state-of-the-art production facility, and he complains about the thickness of the foam on the straps and goes to a power plant that's been under construction for 17 years and is not even finished yet. And there are a few really interesting things here. I know it may sound like kind of a mundane story, but the first off is that this is in a province in northeastern North Korea that borders China and Russia and is one of the least developed in the country. It's also been a place where there's been unrest through the years, the poorest area, and that leads to that unrest. But I think as you sort of start to dive in here, there are two possible explanations for this. One is that Kim Jong-un is preparing for some sort of purge, right? He needs some sort of excuse to point to say this whole cadre of people has been asleep on the job and they need to be removed from their posts or worse, depending on how punishment is dealt out. And the alternative is that this is and kind of why I think this is an interesting story, is it sort of reveals that even a country like North Korea is not a monolith. That even though we see continually a video of Kim Jong-un going and touring various facilities and people obviously under coercion being forced to applaud and cheer for him until their hands are sore, that this country is not a monolith, that there are parts of this country where political leadership is not entirely controlled by Pyongyang, and where leaders in some areas, especially when they're not getting any visits from Kim Jong-un, sort of fall asleep on the job. That much like the Soviet Union before it, during the Stalin era, it's like you can have a strong-willed leader who is notorious for dealing out harsh punishments, but that doesn't mean everybody does their job absolutely perfectly. And I think one bit of analysis here is these people, because it was such an embarrassing province, because there has been unrest there in the past, these people simply said, look, Kim's not going to be coming for several years. We're just not going to progress in development enough. And maybe this is the result of Kim's engagement with the world now, that he is starting to think more about market reforms, trying to figure out ways to improve the North Korean economy, and is applying a little bit more of a critical eye back on his country, yeah. country now that he's seen, especially how other sort of authoritarian leaders manage their own economies.
Like Singapore.
Need to be in ruins.
Yeah.
What do you say?
Like Singapore and China. I mean, you know, he went to both those places in the last year, and they have both just, you know, Singapore, not as recently as China, but both of them have exploded under this combination of authoritarian governance and capitalism, for lack of a better word.
Sure. And I will point out, I probably will agree with those who say this is not a sign of a major purge to come, because there are actually some he's quite critical in these pieces of what's called the OGD in North Korea, which is equivalent to those who know Stalin, Soviet Union, in which you have the NKVD, sort of the central organ of the party that is tasked with sort of carrying out the will of the leader. And in any other circumstance, you sort of see a leader criticizing that central organ, and you say, oh, there's a political risk there, right? This is Kim Jong-un criticizing the people in the government who have probably the most eyes and ears on the people and who are listening to everything. That's a pretty big enemy to pick a fight with, but it could be a sign. Kim's in charge still, back in Pyongyang. Now he's willing to get a little bit more critical as he reaches out around the country. So again, maybe kind of a nuanced story compared to what we had, the big high-stake, obvious diplomacy here in Helsinki, but I find it interesting. It shows that this story about economic development in North Korea will certainly be playing out, and we'll probably get a lot more like this.
It's fascinating. You said you had another one you wanted to share?
Yeah, I will just mention, you know, everybody knows the old adage that, you know, when the government says some policy is going to pay for itself, and economists criticize that in the moment, they're usually right that those projections are overly ambitious. This is a new independent audit by the British government finding that the campaign promise of Brexiteers that there would be a Brexit dividend, a multi-billion dollar a year windfall for public finances in the UK, well, the audit finds that's not going to happen. In fact, they have taken this $13 billion they're going to save on payments annually to the European Union. It's already been appropriated to many other causes, and because the tax base is now going to be lowered after Brexit, there's no Brexit dividend for the United Kingdom. In fact, it appears they may be digging themselves into a fiscal hole. Anyways, the Brexit promises continue to fall far short of what was offered up.
This is going to be a fascinating one to keep an eye on. Luke Vargas, you can follow him at The Courier over on Twitter, and the chief foreign correspondent for Talk Media News. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. Have a good time in Helsinki. It's a beautiful city. We'll be back. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.